we are going to talk about depression this hour, why it is so prevalent, why it is so difficult to control. Will there ever be a cure? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is a research psychologist and the author of The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And he is himself a survivor of severe depression. He describes depression as an evolutionary adaptation, but one that works poorly in our modern environment. Have you suffered from depression? Do you still suffer from depression? How do you deal with it? We'll welcome your questions and your experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Jonathan Rottenberg, research psychologist at the University of South Florida. He's started an online video series, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression, and is the author of the new book, The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Joy.
What motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think that our national conversation about depression is badly broken. So despite very major investments in depression and research, depression treatment, it's not slowed the epidemic of depression. And in fact, I think a lot of people aren't aware that there is a depression epidemic. And moreover, the leading way of understanding depression as a defect in the brain in many ways is a myth and does a disservice to people who are struggling with depression. So between that and my own experiences of depression and trying to struggle with the meanings of moods, I went into psychology and have been working 10 years trying to understand why we have moods, why we have low moods, and why those moods sometimes spiral into severe depression. And I felt compelled both to write this book and to be speaking out about depression and getting people stimulated to talk about it in ways that maybe we have been neglecting.
Yeah. Well, how do you define depression? We often hear about it being a chemical imbalance in the brain. Is that what it is?
Depression does involve biological changes, of course. So does happiness. But depression, the way that I'm defining it, and the serious depression, the way that the World Health Organization defines it when it says that it has a more negative impact in the developed world than cancer, war, or accidents, we're talking about a syndrome, so a number of different symptoms at the same time, in things like having a sad mood, losing interest in things, having feeling fatigued all the time, not being able to sleep, and then some very distressing symptoms like feeling suicidal or feeling that you have no worth whatsoever as a person.
Yeah, and you write, depression's toll has risen even as more research and treatment resources have been poured into combating it. Why is that?
Well, I don't think that you can do a very good job of treating something or analyzing something when you're not thinking about the problem in the right way. So you can have all the smart scientists work in their labs to try additional manipulations of biology to try to cure a defect, but if in fact the problem in depression is that our natural mood system is being acted on in ways that it hasn't been acted on in ways before, we won't be able to make very much progress. If you're treating the wrong problem or if you're mischaracterizing the problem, you can spend all the money in the world and all the time in the world and not make significant progress. And that's really what's happened. I mean, now, so antidepressants were developed actually in the 1950s, believe it or not, the first antidepressants, and there are now 26 different antidepressants. And they work about as well, the more recent ones, as the antidepressants that were developed in the 1950s, which I think, you know, is a shock to a lot of people. Antidepressants, I am not against them, and I think that they've helped many people. They should be among the options that people consider in a multi-pronged approach. But the idea that we've plateaued so that the newer medications, they might be more beneficial in terms of the side effect profile, but in terms of efficacy, there's really no difference.
Yeah. I'd like to talk a little bit about the perception that if people are depressed, clinically depressed, they take, you know, a Prozac and all is well. That's not the case?
It's a little bit of a white lie, to be honest. And, you know, white lies are sometimes, you know, sometimes like white li- it's okay to tell white lies, but I don't think it's okay to tell white lies about people's health. And the white lie is, and this is something that a psychiatrist might say or a primary care physician might say, that we know that you have in your body an imbalance in your brain, very much like a diabetic does with insulin. The problem is with insulin, with diabetes, we can do a blood test, and we know for sure how to diagnose diabetes by your level of blood glucose. And we also know that we can monitor how well the therapy is working by, again, drawing blood or doing other biological assays. In depression, by contrast, we can't do a biological assay. We don't know fundamentally which system in the brain, there's a number of different theories, is disturbed. Moreover, we can't actually monitor what the medication is doing inside of your body. So it's a little bit of a myth, the story that patients are told. And in some ways, it makes me angry because I think that the doctor-patient relationship is based on trust. And I think a lot of psychiatrists and GPs know that it is a little bit of a white lie. There's some truth, of course, to it. That of course, depression does involve changes in biology, and some of the things that are talked about may be involved in depression, but it's not nearly as simple as the diabetes metaphor would make it sound out to be.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your own struggle with depression. What happened?
Sure. In many ways, I think even though I struggled with depression 20 years ago, what happened to me, I feel like, is playing out now. So what happened to me was that I was studying to become a historian. I was living in Baltimore. I was young. I had just gotten out of college. I was just starting graduate school, and I was very confident in myself and my abilities, and thought I was going to, you know, get this PhD and become an academic. And I began to have a number of very troubling symptoms that I did not understand at all, and I did not think of in terms of depression. I thought entirely of physical symptoms, because I felt very weak and unable to get out of bed, and I thought I must have a physical malady. Went to the doctor, of course. And it took a very long time for me to appreciate that this could be a depression. And I did get, very kind and thorough care. It was really mostly with medications. And it took a long time for me to improve, actually a number of years. And I spent time in a psychiatric hospital. And at its worst, I really thought my life was over, that my goose was completely cooked, that I would never do anything ever in my life. But I vowed that I would devote my life to trying to understand how this can happen and what are the sources of mood. And that search, now 20 years later, has, you know, brought me to this book and to this conversation that we're having.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to share your book with a loved one who suffered also from severe depression, and probably about the same age you were when that happened. And we almost lost him. I mean, this is it wasn't something that was easily treated with a pill.
No, and I really do respect people who use medication I don't feel that it's a crutch. I think depression is a very serious adversary, and whatever it takes people to, quote-unquote, get through the night, I think that we just need to think more broadly, both about the sources of a depression and solutions. Certainly in my own case, I've had to think very broadly about my own life in order to flourish after depression, which, again, this book is it's a hard book in that it's asking us to look with wide eyes on a very serious problem. But by the same token, I think we could be doing so much better and think, in a sense, more optimistically. Because what happened to me, having the suicidal fantasies for days and weeks on end and really being reduced as weak as a kitten, that wasn't the end. And I think for many people who have had the frustration, for example, of going on medication treatment repeatedly, they lose hope and they feel that it is the end. This is the end of their life. There's nothing else that can be done. And I think that's actually not correct.
Yeah, well, what else helped you?
Well, it's sort of this takes us to, what are all the different sources of mood? And I hope we'll get mm-hmm. to talk about the different sources of mood, both inside your body, your cognitions, how you think about your moods is important, your interpersonal environment, so who you're associating yourself with, of course, life events, and this notion of meaning. So having things that, and this is back to an evolutionary perspective, our mood system is very responsive to very deep purposes like reproducing, having offspring, caring for other people, things that bring you status, love. These are all things that the mood system happily responds to. And having a kind of a diversity of things in your life that give you purpose, and that's the good news. So for some people, it could be religion. For other people, it could be getting involved in their community. Others, it could be their work, family, having diverse sources. When I got depressed, I really only had one thing, which was my work, the only thing that I think gave my life purpose. And when that started to fail, in many ways, that was the beginning of the downward spiral.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your that you say that depression comes from evolutionary adaptations.
That's right.
What do you mean?
So you can't understand depression unless you ask the question, why is it in the first place that we, when I say we, I mean humans and other species, most clearly in the mammals, have mood. Depression is a mood condition. And so evolution helps us understand why these things came to be and what the function of these things is. So it's easy to understand how a high mood could be useful. If you think of a bear fishing for salmon, and the high mood is motivating that animal to continue to drive itself to pursue those rewards, to reach in the water to pull out those fish. But in turn, we might think, oh, a low mood, that's very useless, but that's not right, because if the bear gets to a fishing spot and there's nothing, nothing in the water, should it just stay in place and starve, be reaching in the water? No, low mood is a mechanism that helps us pull back. It puts a brake on our behavior, especially when our behavior is not paying off, or when we're in a dangerous or risky situation where action would be inadvisable. So, in Wisconsin, I imagine you've had a lot of storms this year, and you've probably seen, look at and you see what animals are doing during the storm, and they're hunkering down. And that's very wise. It's not smart to set out a new track when it's windy and there's no visibility and there's no food, et cetera. That's low mood. That's putting the brakes on behavior. You stay in place. You are considering, what will I do next once things improve? Without that, we would have fewer animals, of course.
Right, and I smile because we're all not just animals, but humans are hunkering down in this winter as well. It's been so brutal.
Absolutely.
And now we're getting some spring fever, at least in parts of the state. There's still a major snowstorm going on in the north, but spring's coming. The days are getting longer and lighter. And are we all going to feel better now?
Well, light is another factor. Mm-hmm. So, you said at the top about this the modern environment and what's the problem with the modern environment. So about 10,000 years ago, humans abandoned our nomadic hunter-gatherer ways and started living in villages, which wasn't by itself so bad. But about 150 years ago, we started to really trade our outside lifestyle of the farmer for the inside lifestyle of the urbanite and the town dweller, and we began to get less and less daylight. And we've evolved to have this 24-hour cycle of mood. We're very, the Earth rotates, and it's light during the day. That's when rewards have been available, and it's dark at night. People aren't actually getting significant amounts of light, even in very sunny places. At night, we're getting all this unwanted light that's coming off of iPads, computer screens, iPhones, and often right before bed and delaying sleep, and people are getting less sleep than before. And so the modern lighting conditions are one thing that are very out of sync with how our moods evolved. You know, we're kind of getting light at all the wrong times, and rather than feeling alert during the day and sleepy at night, lots of people feel like they're kind of the walking dead. They're not alert during the day. They're insufficiently tired at night, and this does have to do with kind of neglecting what we're built, disregarding our natural cycles of light and dark.
We are talking with Jonathan Rottenberg. He is the author of the new book, The Depths: The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your experiences. Do you suffer from depression? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. How did you deal with it? What treatment did or didn't work for you? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about depression during this hour. Depression affects tens of millions of Americans, and despite a lot of research and money going into treatment, we haven't really done a lot to control this epidemic. Our guest calls it an epidemic. He is Jonathan Rottenberg. He is a research psychologist at the University of South Florida, and he is the author of the new book, The Depths: The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. He is also the producer of an online video series, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression. Lots more to ask him, but you, a lot of callers too, so let's go to Maddie in Wapaka. Hi, Maddie.
Hello. Yes, I had a nervous breakdown in 1979. I was diagnosed with major clinical depression. And the next 2 years was very difficult for me. And the medication helped a lot, but there still were breakthrough times when depression would be overwhelming. And a few years ago, maybe 6 years ago or so already, I heard a doctor talking on your show about the importance of vitamin D, and that most of us weren't getting enough. And I started taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D every day, and I have never felt better. And it's been a steady thing, and I have a lot more energy than I had, besides not being depressed.
Maddie, I'm happy that helped you. And, of course, our guest is not a medical doctor, but Jonathan Rottenberg, can you comment on Maddie feeling a whole lot better now that she's taking vitamin D?
I can comment on her attitude that she felt that she wasn't satisfied with the treatment that she was getting. And well, she listened to your show, and she got another idea. And I really think that people need to take a more active approach to their own mood. So for one person, that's great. Vitamin D might help. For another, it might be exercise that really makes a difference, or changing your sleep routine that makes a difference, changing the amount of light that you're getting that makes a difference. The good news is that there's so many different things that influence mood, some of them profoundly. And unfortunately, a lot of people are in the position of just taking the medication and waiting for it to work. And that's, I think, not going to produce the kind of results that people want.
Thank you, Maddie, for the call. We have Joan in Williams Bay with us now. Hi, Joan.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I was listening to you. You're interviewing the author of this book, and the book sounds like it would be a little confusing, but, you know, it also sounds like he was pretty hard on himself and scared when he got depressed after he said his work failed. I mean, you're entitled to a certain amount of depression after you lose something, you know, like a family member or like a teenager is, you know, has to have a little time to reconstruct after he's leaving home and losing his old prior, you know, identity, his old identity and everything, and give himself time to adjust to something new. And did he cover that?
Well, Joan, what's confusing you? What is it that you want to know?
Well, he's throwing everything in, like affective disorder, you know, under depression. Depression can be not be a medical thing. It could be a normal, healthy thing following the loss of something.
Yeah, all right, so I get it. She's maybe you're on the same page, Jonathan
Rundberg.
We're on
the same page.
Yeah.
Actually, not only are we on the same page, I would expand on Joan's comments. One of the drivers, I think, of the depression epidemic, certainly in the United States, is our expectations about how we ought to feel. And how long should people have to grieve something going poorly in their life, whether it's a problem in your marriage or a problem in your work? My sense is, in the research that I've investigated, concludes not very long. We have incredibly high expectations for how we ought to feel. This is driven by multiple sources, but the result is when someone is feeling down, rather than saying this is a natural response to this situation that's going to require some adjustment and some rethinking, the person thinks, what's wrong with me? There must be something wrong with me. It's not normal to have these feelings. In many ways, I think that Joan has the right attitude.
Yeah, and maybe the confusing part is that we're talking about evolution. Maybe you can expand a little bit on that, as to why we're still seeing the numbers we are in terms of depression, that it's depression is this epidemic, in part because you think our modern environment is playing into that, and that's why we are seeing such high numbers.
Well, absolutely. So we have a perfectly good adaptation, but it's not perfect, and this would be true of other adaptations that can, in some ways, put us in harm's way. So I think most of your listeners would agree that it's useful to have some degree of anxiety or fear, and that's clearly an evolutionary adaptation and help us avoid harm and danger. In an organism that did not have that capacity, would get run over in 5 minutes. And fear can also lead to all sorts of problems with anxiety conditions. So if we think about depression in the same way and ask, well, why is this perfectly good adaptation now getting us into a lot of trouble? There are many things in the modern environment. So the pace of evolution is very slow. But the changes in our genes are very slow, but the changes in our environment are very fast, much faster than evolution can kind of keep up with. And so we have kind of a mismatch between what we're wired to do and the environments that we're facing.
Yeah. Joan was also wondering, at what point does depression become a disorder, disabling?
Yeah, so I think the book is relatively unique in thinking about mood on a continuum, which is to say that low mood varies all the way from a little bit of the the blues that you can notice, that you can sort of act on, to a disabling low mood in which you really can't do anything except lie in bed in kind of reel in pain. Many of the forces that act on mood and produce these extremes are the same forces. So your cognitions, what's going on in your body, your social environment, major events affect both whether you're in a little bit of a low mood or in a severe depression. So it's really not two different things. It's one system. But of course, we notice when we're really disabled by a low mood, we of course think that something is the matter, because something is the matter. So even if it isn't a disease, because it's not a disease, it's still a big problem. It's a big problem when someone is unable to concentrate or feels fatigued. So I very much am for trying to find ways to manage moods better than we currently are.
Let's go to John in Grand Rapids. Hello, John.
Good morning. I'm going through this as a parent of a young adult who is also a student, and I just wanted to, I don't know if the doctor has any suggestions or anything, but my question is concerning HIPAA laws, and or my concern more is concerning HIPAA laws and confidentiality and continuity of treatment, which is totally not happening in Wisconsin anyway, and I suspect everywhere. But I've gone through two episodes in the last few months of not knowing if my child was dead or alive, and the system won't tell you where he is, if he's there, or even acknowledge that he exists. And as a parent whose child is also being covered by our insurance, you know, I can't tell you how frustrating it is and stressful to not know if your child's dead or alive or where they are, and you have competing resources like law enforcement out there looking for them while they're in an institution involuntarily, and nobody will tell you, and you are basically the only continuity of treatment they get because you're communicating with multiple providers, and the left arm basically doesn't know what the right arm's doing, and therefore the treatment is basically non-existent. You're only dealing with the immediate symptoms and never getting at the root of the issue.
You know what? This sounds familiar to me. Jonathan Rottenberg?
Well, you know, I appreciate the question. I can't speak to the HIPAA laws, but I understand the distress, and the there are many problems with how care is being delivered. Not enough, not coordinated, haphazard. One of the really things that bothers me is how cursory assessments of depression tend to be. So a lot of people are seen, and this might not be the case here, but a lot of people are evaluated for depression by a general practitioner who has fine medical training but very little training specifically in mental health. And the consultation may last all of 5 or 10 or 12 minutes, and very soon the prescription pad gets whipped out, and I don't think the person is ever given a sense for all the different sources that are driving their mood, and consequently, they're just put in a posture of waiting for the medication to kick in. And I think that depression is a serious enough problem that it deserves a more serious search for what might be happening in the child or the adult's life.
Thanks, John, for the call. Heidi on Facebook says, as someone who battles depression, one of the things that makes it so hard to deal with is that you feel like you aren't worth anything. It's hard to find the motivation, energy, and internal fortitude to take the steps to maintain yourself mentally and physically, because why do all the work on someone who is worthless? I know people care about me, but I'm the one who has to live with that constantly, and that's the grind down.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me sad to hear that, because there are people that care, including me. And I really think that one of the main things we need to do is try to break down the isolation. There's still tremendous stigma and shame that surround depression. Someone is in the hospital because you know, they were in a car accident and that they hurt their back and they can't get out of bed. People come and they bring a casserole and they are say, "What can I do to help?" If someone's in the hospital with a lot of the same problems, they can't get out of bed, but the reason is that they're depressed. People don't know what to say. People don't know what to do, and I think that there's a lot that we can do to begin to break down this confusion and to have a better conversation about depression. And that, I think, is going to really do a lot to reduce this feeling of that I'm a worthless person and that people don't care about me. It's not true, but people who have struggle with depression and people who are struggling with depression and their caregivers really need to talk more than they do to kind of break down this isolation.
Yeah. How do you propose we take back our national conversation about depression?
Well, I mean, I've started a campaign called Come Out of the Dark, and it has a couple of different elements, and there are other people doing similar campaigns that I think are using things like social media to enable people to connect with one another and to give people tools for talking about depression. So coming out of the dark is a very profound thing. So in the sense that people who have had depression feel like they need to hide, that they can't talk with other people, that their families don't understand them. So, for example, I have a photo gallery where people share their stories and their pictures, and I've been sending bracelets that say "Come Out of the Dark" with them, and people will are very grateful to receive these, and it's very empowering to know that there are thousands of other people wearing these bracelets, and they can go and they can see, and they can communicate with other people who have been through similar things. Right now, depression is just so profoundly isolating that people feel like that they have it the worst, that no one understands them, that no one cares about them. And this, unfortunately, doesn't happen for other conditions. And other conditions, we see how things can change. I mean, things have changed dramatically with, for example, breast cancer. I mean, there was a time when that was an unspeakable condition if you had cancer, and you couldn't even whisper the word in some circles. And that makes the burden of, you know, it's bad enough to have something wrong with your body, but even worse if you can't talk to your friends about it, if you feel that you're a leper, that you've kind of been banished. And I think that we can do the same thing that we've done for breast cancer for depression.
Well, so beyond, I guess, coming out of the dark and wearing bracelets and being open about it, how do we talk about depression to, I don't know, make a difference besides...
We're doing it right now. So one of the first things is to acknowledge that there's a problem. And I think that in many ways we've been in denial that our society has really a significant problem. And then the other is to begin to break it down and to give people hope, because it's not just that there's a problem that we can't do anything about. There are other ways of thinking about depression, and they point to a whole other set of solutions, and to give people tools to start thinking about their mood. And to be more, so if you're having a problem with depression, there are lots of things that you can do to come to understand your mood. And then if you overcome depression, one of the big things is that right now you generally don't talk to other people about this. And I think it's really unfortunate that people who have struggled with depression don't share what they've learned with people who might still be struggling. And so I'm very interested, and we see this in the area of addictions. So in the area of addictions, people who have had a drug problem or an alcohol problem and have overcome it very often are still talking about this and trying to help people who still might be, having a problem with addictions. But with depression, once someone has put it behind them, they generally don't want to ever talk about it ever again. I was that way. I understand that mentality, but it would actually be more helpful both to the person who has struggled and overcome, and to the people who are still out there struggling, because you're a model. You give other people hope because you show not as in theory possible. It is in reality possible, and so that's one of the issues is that depression is a condition where people very profoundly lose hope in the future. And I think there's a whole host of ways in which we can restore hope, but not by having the same conversation over and over again about how depressed people are defective and they need to take drugs, and all those drugs don't work, so just wait longer, et cetera, et cetera. That, I think, is very demoralizing.
So do you call yourself a depression survivor?
I don't know if I like the word survivor, but I won't say no to that. I mean, I think that I'm someone who's struggled with depression and mood, and it's changed me forever. I have a sort of a different way of thinking about that struggle. So, in our culture, we don't tend to have a lot of tolerance for these feeling states. You know, people who have depression are a drag, and what's wrong with them, and why can't they just snap out of it? But the truth is that you imagine what someone who struggles with depression, with a serious depression, has gone through. So certainly for me and for millions of other people, having to marshal the energy just to get out of bed, let alone get through your day, being cognitively impaired so badly that you go from someone who was reading and writing on a high level to someone who can barely go grocery shopping, and have that go on for years. So if you've overcome that, you're in a sense, you're a kind of warrior. You've been through something that is really not something that a lot of other people, well, you know, the minority of people, you know, have been through, and you've done it. That's really, that's a testament to your strength rather than, a tribute to, you know, how weak you are.
So we are talking with a depression warrior.
That's right.
Yeah, Jonathan Rottenberg, research psychologist at the University of South Florida, author of the book The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And we welcome your questions for him and your stories, and we will get to your calls, as many as we can, for the rest of the hour. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the origins of depression with the author of the new book, The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic, Jonathan Rottenberg, who is himself a warrior of severe depression. And we're talking with him about how he would like to take back our national conversation about depression. He started a new online video series on that. Let's go to some calls and take our next caller, Linda in Clintonville. Hello, Linda.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk to your guest today. I am depressed. I have been since 2000. I've been diagnosed. I have lost since 2000. Pretty much everything, friends, jobs, time. And what happened to me in 2011 is I ended up with cancer. And I was treated, and the treatment was successful. And what I have noticed is that when I tell people that I am depressed, I get very little feedback or anything back from them. However, when I tell them I've had cancer, maybe in the same conversation, they seem to understand it more. They seem to say, oh, you know, that's terrible. I feel so bad for you. And actually, my cancer has not taken away as much as my depression has. And I have been near death several times with my depression. I don't know how I survive, to tell you the truth. I do go to counseling. I take medications. but I don't know. I have people that will walk away from me. My whole life has changed, and I do want to say that I even had a psychiatrist tell me not to go back to school. It'd be too much. Well, you know what? I did go back to school. I got another degree while I was really, really depressed. It was probably one of the hardest things I did, but I did it.
Yeah.
And I graduated with honors. And
good for you, Linda. I'm Jonathan, do you have any words of wisdom for Linda?
I do. Well, Linda knows. I mean, mm-hmm. Linda knows. She knows depression as well as anyone, having struggled with it from 2000 on. And I think her experience is very profound. I mean, the most optimist. There's two very optimistic things that I can say, which is that we know that depressions end. They end. They don't go on forever. We know that from epidemiological research. And sometimes it's a matter of time. Sometimes it's a matter of finding the right medications, changing your environment. The other thing I would say is that the what she describes is people's reactions to her saying that she's depression, we can change that. So there have been remarkable developments. No one would have foreseen 15 years ago that gay people could be married and their love could be recognized in so many places. There's been a huge change in a very small short amount of time in social attitudes towards that formerly stigmatized identity as a gay person. So too, I believe that things can, and I think that they will change with depression. And I think it's actually younger people who are going to be leading the charge. Younger people don't understand why it should be that you can't talk about depression. It's older people, and this is no disrespect for them, but they have had more decades of living with these notions that, well, what's wrong with you? Why don't you just snap out of it, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm really trying to involve young people and come out of the dark, and I'm amazed with how optimistic they are about the future. So I really do think that change is in the air.
Thank you so much, Linda, for the call. Glad you joined us. Ray in Rhinelander is with us. Hello, Ray.
Yes, thank you very much again for this wonderful show. This person that you have on definitely has done his homework from life experience, etc. I used to be in the business of therapy, so to speak. I have a degree. I worked with dual diagnosis. I worked with people that had addiction problems, etc., etc. Anyways, I've seen... The thing I'm concerned about is the evolution of mental health and treatment in this country, what has happened since the Reagan generation, what was changed from the government down as far as funding, et cetera, program change, all those different things. And I'm very concerned about now how management, therapy, and control is combined. I really agree with your guest on therapy, talking, and taking the time to possibly try and get to the root of the problem. Some of these things happen because of biochemical disturbances, from life experiences, or a combination of addiction and everything else. The thing is that if we could spend more time with therapy, a variety of different therapies catered to the individual symptoms of the person and their life experience and what can possibly be with their potentials, and to restructure these things in a broader range of therapies, I think we would have a better chance with this. You know, I agree there are some people that need to be institutionalized for a while, depending on the situation. And, yes, we do need medications. But it seems like too much is done, again, for the control of management and therapy. So with that comment, I'll take his comment off the air. And thank you very much for being on the show. You definitely know what you're talking about.
Thanks, Ray. Jonathan?
Well, thanks for those nice words, Ray. I guess what I would say is that we absolutely do need to take a range of therapies more seriously, and it is a dollar and cents issue, but not in the way that people typically think. So people typically think, oh, this is such an expensive problem, and, oh, you know, he's suggesting we spend more money on it. But this is, the employers actually have a huge amount to gain. Depression is one of the most expensive health problems in terms of absenteeism, in terms of people having reduced productivity on the job, turnover. And so this is an investment. If employers have more generous mental health benefits, there are actually studies and data that show that this pays off. So if you have better depression screening, if you have more comprehensive treatment, if you allow people more sessions, if you make it more inviting, and people fear going into treatment, of course, because they're afraid, oh, my employer will find out, I'm going to get fired in many cases. But if you change that, the bottom line may be, in fact, better than if you don't make that investment. And that's because, as you know, Ray suggests, that depression has such a profound effect on people's functioning. We're really wasting a huge amount of human capital in the United States right now.
One more call. Mary in Viroqua. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I guess I'm feeling more isolated for having listened to this program than not. I don't mean any disrespect. I really don't. But I've been suffering from severe depression for a long, long time. And your guest mentioned something about avenues of hope and that. And I wish that you had spent more time talking about that, because I've done the therapy. I have done everything under the sun to try to help my depression, and I do take antidepressants. They take the edge off a little bit. They keep me from being completely dysfunctional. But you know, I just
yeah, I'm afraid, and I'm Mary. I'm one of the reasons maybe we didn't explore is that we're coming up on a break. But what? Let's end on more on the avenues of hope, Jonathan.
Yeah. So you know, I know our time is short, but I would really, really suggest, Mary, that you read my book, because I mentioned some of the things that people can do to better understand the sources of their mood. And we've talked about things like sleep, light, physical activity, changing your cognitions. But that absolutely does not exhaust the profound things that affect mood. So looking at what goals you have, looking at how you respond to your low moods, these are all things that people can change and things that will make a difference over the long run in the moods that you're having. So I obviously we didn't have a time to go into all the different things that you've tried, but I'm very confident that if you're patient and you work through and are willing to experiment, that you can put your mood in a better place than it is now.
Yeah, and Jonathan Rottenberg, does it? Will we ever have a cure for depression?
I don't think that we'll ever have a cure. I mean, low mood is part of the human condition, but I think we can do much better about managing low mood and putting it in a box so that it's something that that we all have to some degree, but not something that controls us, not something that rules us, not something that that makes us think that this is, you know, the end of our life, that we'll never be able to flourish.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Rottenberg is the author of The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.